So we're going to talk about hematopoietic cell transplantation. So this is, I see some familiar faces, so it's going to be very much the same. So the goals for today are to be able to define hematopoietic cell transplantation, to know how it's done and how you can tailor the circumstances of the transplant to fit the patient's disease and circumstances, and then also to briefly talk about what some of the clinical problems are in hematopoietic cell transplantation. So some of the important concepts that you need to learn from today, and by learn I mean be able to define, is the difference between an autologous and allogeneic stem cell transplant, difference between myeloablative and reduced intensity conditioning regimens, and why in general they are chosen, how to differentiate between an autologous, syngeneic, match-related, match-unrelated, mismatched, and haploidentical donor, what the difference is between acute versus chronic graft versus host disease, and we'll also talk about donor chimerism if there's time. So what is a hematopoietic cell transplant? This is the transfer of hematopoietic progenitor and stem cells for therapeutic purposes. And so there are lots of different terms that we use, such as bone marrow transplant versus hematopoietic stem cell transplant versus hematopoietic progenitor cell transplant. And so these are, usually you can think of them as interchangeable. The only difficulty is if you're talking to a transplanter and then he'll probably want you to know what the difference is between bone marrow versus, for example, a peripheral blood stem cell transplant. But in general, if you use any of these words, most people will know what you're talking about. So this is the entire basis of hematopoietic cell transplantation. This is the this is how hematopoiesis occurs in human beings. And so what we have is the hematopoietic stem cell here, which undergoes self-renewal, and then this stem cell can differentiate into a common lymphoid progenitor versus a common myeloid progenitor. The lymphoid progenitors eventually become T lymphocytes and B lymphocytes. The common myeloid progenitor becomes the granulocytes and the monocytes. And so the entire reason that we're able to do stem cell transplants is because we're able to take these cells from the patient or from another person and transfer them into the same patient later on or into a different person. So this is what, this stem cell is what gives rise to all these cells. And so if we transplanted these mature cells out here, they wouldn't last very long in the recipient. They would last, you know, maybe a few days, and then you would be stuck with the same situation you had, which was a failed bone marrow. Whereas if you transfer the hematopoietic stem cell, this sets up in the bone marrow and eventually starts generating all of these, and it continues to generate all of the mature cells, hopefully until the end of the patient's life. So we're going to talk about the difference between an autologous versus an allogeneic hematopoietic cell transplant. Basically, an autologous transplant is a transplant using the patient's own cells for the graft. So in this case, it would be the patient's own hematopoietic stem cells. An allogeneic transplant is one using another person's hematopoietic stem cells for the graft. So an issue that comes up is how do you define a transplant from an identical twin to the other identical twin? Any takers? Because after all, these are, you don't count because you've heard this question before. so the answer is that if you get a transplant from your syngeneic twin, you are getting an allogeneic transplant. It's not an autologous transplant. And so that's, you know, that's just the way it's been defined. And even though it is technically the same genotype, it is a different person, so it's considered an allogeneic transplant. Okay, this is the schema for an autologous transplant. Basically, we have a patient who has a disease that is amenable to autologous transplant, like myeloma. this represents the patient's bone marrow. These are the hematopoietic stem cells and other bone marrow cells. And so the patient will typically undergo a course of chemotherapy, sometimes, usually not radiation therapy, but they'll undergo a course of the standard chemotherapy. And so this chemotherapy will reduce the tumor burden in the patient's body and bone marrow. So that's why these cancerous cells in pink have gone from 4 to 1 in this diagram. So in the process of the regular chemotherapy, the stem cells are relatively preserved. Sometimes they get damaged in the process of the chemotherapy, but for the most part, they remain. And once the patient has had his myeloma reduced enough, then this patient undergoes a collection of his or her bone marrow or peripheral blood stem cells. So in myeloma, it's almost always peripheral blood stem cells. And these cells are collected and then they're frozen and we store them in the freezer. At that point, the recipient goes through high-dose chemotherapy. And the effect of this chemotherapy is to hopefully get rid of this last bit of tumor or myeloma that is remaining in the patient. The unfortunate side effect of all that chemotherapy is that this chemotherapy also destroys all of the bone marrow so that hematopoiesis will no longer occur in that patient. And so not being able to generate red blood cells, platelets, white blood cells is not compatible with life in the long run. So to rescue the patient from this side effect, we will give the hematopoietic stem cells that have been stored frozen in the freezer. So these go into the patient, it goes in through the vein, and then these cells regrow over about 2 to 3 weeks, and then you have restoration of hematopoiesis. So the important thing to know about an autologous transplant is that giving the cells back, the actual cellular transplant part of the procedure, doesn't really do anything against the tumor. All of the therapeutic power from an autologous transplant comes from the high-dose chemotherapy. It's the chemotherapy that kills off the myeloma cells. And we're just giving the stem cells to rescue the patient from the adverse effects of that chemotherapy. So these are some of the indications for high-dose chemotherapy and autologous hematopoietic cell transplant. The first is replacement of hematopoiesis. So this is the rescue therapy that goes on after the high-dose chemotherapy. And then the second is the treatment of diseases for which cytoreduction is effective and dose-dependent. So certain tumors that respond to higher doses of chemotherapy are particularly suited for an autologous transplant, such as germ cell tumors like testicular cancer, large cell lymphoma, mantle cell lymphoma, and myeloma. So the reason that we have to choose tumors that are responsive to high-dose chemotherapy is because if they are not responsive to high-dose chemotherapy and you get the same effect with standard chemotherapy doses, then it's not worth the toxicity to the patient to give the high-dose chemotherapy. You don't have to go through this somewhat complicated process of collecting cells, storing cells, giving them back, if you're just going to give normal dose chemotherapy, because normal dose chemotherapy does not ablate the marrow. So these are two cytotoxicity versus chemotherapy doses. So essentially, this is how the tumor responds to chemotherapy. So in this diagram, as you increase the chemotherapy dose, you have more killing of the tumor. And then in this diagram on the left, as you increase chemotherapy, you get less and less response from the tumor. So if we think about what sorts of tumors would be responsive to an autologous hematopoietic cell transplant, which tumor would you rather choose to do a transplant for? Any? Which one? This one? Right. So you would want this one, because when you give the high dose of chemotherapy, which you can give in an autologous transplant, you have increased tumor killing. Whereas if you give this dose, if you had this tumor and you gave a high dose of chemotherapy, as in this red dotted line, you're not getting any benefit from the high dose chemotherapy. You're just, essentially, you're getting the toxicity you would have to give a stem cell rescue to save the patient from the effects of the chemotherapy. But you wouldn't get any benefit in terms of killing off of the tumor. So this is the basic process for an allogeneic hematopoietic cell transplant. It's very similar to an autologous, except that instead of the patient providing his or her own stem cells, an unrelated or a related donor provides the stem cells. And so usually these patients have a disease like leukemia, represented by these pink cells, and they go through the standard chemotherapy. The standard chemotherapy reduces the tumor burden in the patient. Once the tumor burden is low enough, we will bring the patient in, and assuming that there's a donor that has already been found, we'll bring the patient in and we'll give him or her a myeloablative regimen, plus with or without radiation. The conditioning regimen kills off the majority of the leukemia cells, although usually there's a tiny little bit that's left behind. In the process, the conditioning regimen also kills off the bone marrow cells here. So this is, once again, not a state compatible with life. So to rescue the patient, we also give an infusion of donor cells. The donor hematopoietic stem cells set up shop in the bone marrow, and then they start growing over anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks. And then with time, usually several months, the donor stem cells will react against the leukemia that was left behind and get rid of it. So what's implicit in this sort of procedure is that there is an immunologic effect against the leukemia from the donor stem cells. And you know, that's probably one of the most important differences between an autologous and allogeneic transplant, other than the use of different donors. So these are some of the indications for an allogeneic hematopoietic cell transplant. One is replacement of hematopoiesis. So for example, in a disease like aplastic anemia, where the bone marrow for some reason stops producing red blood cells, you can give a hematopoietic cell transplant. The other two reasons are for treatment of disease. One is treatment against disease that is still present in the patient, and this can be accomplished also by the chemotherapy in an allogeneic transplant, but also by the immune-mediated effects from the donor cells. And then the last indication is to prevent relapse. So sometimes we will have a patient who had leukemia, but for whom we can no longer detect leukemia, but we always think that there's a little bit hiding in there. So to prevent this patient from relapsing, we will give an allogeneic transplant as well. Okay, so these are some things to think about. What sorts of tumor characteristics are amenable to an autologous versus an allogeneic transplant? So for example, something like being responsive to immune-mediated effects would make you lean towards giving an allogeneic transplant. And then something to think about for later on is what tumor characteristics lend themselves to a myeloablative versus a reduced intensity conditioning regimen. Okay. So these are the some old survival outcomes. It's a little bit different now, but it's enough to give you an idea of what happens to patients who receive an allogeneic transplant. So approximately, and so by survival I mean what are the causes of death. So, you know, in the long term, about 20% of patients who undergo an allogeneic transplant are alive and well. About 15% will be alive, but they will have some complication of transplant, usually chronic graft-versus-host disease. About 20% will relapse because their disease comes back. Some 15% will die of complications of transplant, so about 15% will die of chronic graft-versus-host disease. 5% will die of other causes, 10% will die of infection, and then 15% will die of acute graft-versus-host disease. So really, it's probably about less than half who survive long-term after an allogeneic transplant, and about half of that half will have some sort of complication of transplant that they have to deal with. So then you kind of ask yourself, well, what's the point of doing an allogeneic transplant? Especially if you have so much morbidity and mortality, some of it from the procedure itself, but some of it from other reasons. And so the reason is that if you have your typical patient with leukemia that undergoes an allogeneic transplant, so this is a patient that's diagnosed with leukemia, and then they get leukemia therapy, and then they're put in what's called remission, so we can't see any disease as far as we can tell with our testing methods. Why wouldn't you just take your chances and do the normal therapy instead of going on to an allogeneic transplant with all of the risks that an allogeneic transplant brings? And so the reason is that, as physicians, we're always worried that even though we can't see disease in the patient, that there is some little speck of disease in there that eventually grows and ruins the patient's life and maybe your own life in the process. And so with certain kinds of leukemia, there's a high risk of disease recurrence. So, in certain types of leukemia, about 80% of them will relapse at some future time point. And so to prevent this relapse, we will give an allogeneic transplant. So for example, this is the allogeneic transplant arm, and then this is the traditional chemotherapy arm. And so if you are in relapse and if you are in complete remission and you have a bad prognosis leukemia, then chances are 95% that the leukemia will come back and that you'll die. You have a 5% chance of being alive long-term if you do nothing. Whereas if you decide, this is really not acceptable to me, I'm not going to choose the option where there's a 95% chance that I'm going to be dead, I want to do something else about my disease, then you'll go through an allogeneic transplant. And if you follow the outcomes out from an allogeneic transplant, you would see that about 35% are alive, some of them have problems, but 65% are dead. So you can choose a 35% chance of being alive, or you can choose a 5% chance of being alive. And so even though on the surface it sounds like something that is not fun and not desirable, if you look at the numbers, the chance of surviving after an allogeneic transplant are actually better than compared to not doing anything for certain types of leukemias. And so that's why some patients will choose to take this option instead of not doing anything. So this is old data, and this is an example of the prognostication that we do. So NPM1 is a genetic mutation that predicts for good prognosis leukemia. So in these patients, if you do transplant versus no transplant, you have the same risk of relapse. So if you had a patient with NPM1 positive leukemia but FLT3 negative, then you really wouldn't recommend doing an allogeneic transplant because the survival is the same. The relapse-free survival is the same after an allogeneic transplant versus just traditional chemotherapy. If you had another mutation besides NPM1, then you might consider recommending an allogeneic transplant because if this is the relapse-free survival for patients who underwent an allogeneic transplant compared to those who did not, then this is much preferable. It's preferable to have this curve than to be on this curve. So this is old data. There's actually more recent data that demonstrates that if you have NPM1 positive leukemia, that the curves actually look more like this. But this is just an example of how you would prognosticate for a patient whether or not he or she should go through an allogeneic transplant. And so this is a similar picture. So these are the usual prognostic categories for AML. And so NPM1 used to be a good prognostic category, but it was when I made the slide, but it's not anymore. So we crossed it out. But these are the other good prognostic factors like translocation 821, translocation 922, inversion 16. If you have a normal karyotype or multiple karyotypic abnormalities, then it's predicted that you are not likely to stay in remission just with plain chemotherapy. And so typically we would recommend that you go on to allogeneic transplant at that time. Okay, so this is just a comparison between autologous and allogeneic transplants. Both can be used to replace hematopoiesis. Both utilize cytoreduction of the tumor. For an allogeneic transplant, there is an immune effect. Traditionally, for an autologous transplant, we say no, although there is some evidence coming out that there may also be. And then with regard to chemotherapy dose and the conditioning regimen, the doses are high in an autologous transplant, but they can be high and low in an allogeneic transplant. Okay, so now we're going to talk about the difference between a myeloablative and a reduced intensity conditioning regimen. This is the schema that we've all seen before. And so implicit in this picture is that there is an immunologic effect that occurs in an allogeneic transplant against the leukemia. And so these immunologic effects come in two flavors. One is called the graft versus tumor effect, which is the reaction of the donor's immune system against the recipient's malignancy. And then the other side of the coin is the graft versus host effect, which is the reaction of the donor's immune system against the recipient's body tissues. So this is a picture that we like to show, and it shows that the graft versus host effect is the other side of the coin for the graft versus tumor effect, in this case, the graft versus leukemia effect. And so on the y-axis is the increasing probability of relapse, and time is on the x-axis. And these patients are grouped according to how much graft versus host effect was actually observed in them. So on this, in this top curve is the amount of graft versus host disease that is seen in patients who receive their identical twins. So an allogeneic transplant, but an identical twin for their disease. And so these, because these patients received essentially the same genotype, they're not predicted to have very much graft versus host disease at all. And so because of that, they also have the curve with the highest relapse rates. Down here at the very bottom are patients who got both acute graft versus host disease and chronic graft versus host disease. And so what we see is that they have the least likelihood of relapsing over time. And then kind of in the middle are patients who had acute GVHD only, chronic GVHD only, and then no GVHD. And so what basically this is showing is that if you have lots of graft versus host disease, you are less likely to relapse than if you have very little graft versus host disease. Okay, so we've seen these curves before. This is the cell-killing or cytotoxicity curve versus chemotherapy dose. And this is the curve that is best that goes with an autologous transplant. This is the kind of curve that you don't want with an autologous transplant here. And so down here are the corresponding toxicity versus chemotherapy curves for these curves up here. So if you see this kind of curve, you would typically expect that as you go up in the chemotherapy dose, you also have an increase in patient toxicity. That's why in an autologous transplant, with an increase in toxicity. So what kind of curve, if you were going to put this curve here over here, would you expect to see with this kind of cytotoxicity versus chemotherapy dose curve? Would you see something that looks like this, or would you see a curve that kind of goes up and plateaus? Like this?
No.
Like this. Right. Okay. So this is the same sort of curve that you would see. So essentially what this is telling you is that as you go up in chemotherapy dose, you have more toxicity. But in this kind of tumor, you may not necessarily have more cell killing. So, you know, so toxicity is a big problem that we see in myeloablative allogeneic transplants. So allogeneic transplants that use high dose chemotherapy. And so, what was hypothesized was that in leukemia, maybe this is the sort of thing that we see, that these are the tumor characteristics in leukemia rather than this. Although certainly this exists probably for some leukemia. So because of this differential in cytotoxicity versus patient toxicity, we started doing reduced intensity conditioning transplants. And so these are essentially allogeneic transplants, but instead of the high dose chemotherapy that we use, we give a reduced dose of chemotherapy, just enough to get the donor cells into the patient and get them to grow. There's enough cytoreduction to hold any remaining leukemia in check. And with the intent that because these donor cells are now in the recipient, that the donor cells can exert an immunologic effect against the leukemia and cure the patient. So these very smart Germans proposed this, and they actually did a trial that proved it. And so what they did was they randomized our patients to standard conditioning, which is myeloablative, versus reduced intensity conditioning. So the blue is standard conditioning, and then the red is reduced intensity conditioning. And so they looked at things like what the overall survival was, what the relapse rate was, and what the non-relapse mortality was. So essentially a measure of how toxic the regimen was. So what they found was that in terms of relapse, it didn't really make a difference whether or not you got a reduced intensity versus a myeloablative regimen. In terms of survival, you actually had a little bit more survival, although it wasn't statistically significant, if you between reduced intensity versus myeloablative groups. And then, so this is the relapse curve, which reflects what you see up here. And then this is the toxicity curve. And so what we see is that there is less toxicity with reduced intensity conditioning versus standard conditioning. And so these were all the patients. And so the differences aren't that great because there was a mix of young and old patients. But if you stratify the patients by age, that's when you start to see the really big differences. So this is the non-relapse mortality. So this is a representation of how much toxicity occurs because of the transplant. The blue is the standard conditioning arm. The red is the reduced intensity conditioning arm. And so what we see is that if you're older than 40, in the 41 to 60 year old range, there's a big difference in how toxic you get depending on what your conditioning regimen is. If you're younger than 40, 18 to 40, it really doesn't make a difference. So because the curves are essentially the same, and mostly because the toxicity is less, is why in older patients we will use a reduced intensity conditioning regimen versus a fully myeloablative allogeneic conditioning regimen. So this is just, you know, another way of looking at myeloablative conditioning versus reduced intensity conditioning. This is the conditioning regimen that you get before transplant. With a myeloablative conditioning regimen, you have no recovery of the recipient's hematopoiesis, and then you eventually die. With a reduced intensity conditioning regimen, there is slow but some recovery of the patient's native hematopoiesis, so it is possible to have reconstitution, although even in these cases, we try not to let the patients go too long without another transplant to rescue them. Okay. So this is the reason that we're able to change whether or not we do a reduced intensity versus a myeloablative conditioning regimen. It all depends on the chemotherapy drug dose and the radiation dose. On the far right are the myeloablative regimens, and on the left are the non-myeloablative and reduced intensity conditioning regimens. As we move towards right, there's more patient toxicity. As we move towards left, there is supposed to be more relapse, although we've also now seen data that suggests that it may be about the same, actually. So this is hematopoiesis, which we talked about earlier. So now we'll talk about why some of these drugs are used for myeloablative conditioning regimens versus others. So if you look in the myeloablative box, we typically use drugs like busulfan and melphalan, and we use radiation doses that are high. So this is 1200 centigrades of total body irradiation. And that's compared to the reduced intensity and non-myeloablative regimens, which use much smaller doses of radiation, so 400 centigrades in the reduced intensity box and then 200 centigrades in the non-myeloablative box. And so what we also see is that we don't very much use these stem cell toxic drugs like busulfan or melphalan in the non-myeloablative or reduced intensity conditioning arms. Okay. So this is where certain drugs affect the affect hematopoiesis. So if you give full dose total body irradiation, about 1200 centigrades, versus melphalan or busulfan, then these agents affect the entire process of hematopoiesis, especially this stem cell down here. If we look at a drug like fludarabine, which we don't really use in myeloablative regimens except as an adjunct, but we use more commonly in reduced intensity versus reduced intensity and non-myeloablative regimens, then we see that the fludarabine really only affects the lymphocytes. It doesn't affect the hematopoietic stem cells. And that's the reason that we are able to give it in a reduced intensity and a non-myeloablative regimen, because it does not destroy the stem cell. If we look at another drug called cyclophosphamide, we see that it affects all of these more mature cells, but once again, it spares the hematopoietic stem cell. And so that's why we're able to use these differently. It just depends on what the targets are, and because of the different targets, we can use them in different ways, either to myeloablate the patient or to give a reduced intensity conditioning regimen. Okay, so this is how cyclophosphamide is metabolized. And so here we see that it does not affect the hematopoietic stem cell. So this has recently come into use in transplantation, and really it's changed the way that we've done transplants. And it has this special property of not affecting the hematopoietic stem cells very much. And this is why it does not affect the hematopoietic stem cells. So this is how cyclophosphamide is broken down in patients. It becomes autophosphamide, and then it can become basically phosphoramide mustard, which is the active metabolite in patients, or acrolein, which is also the active metabolite and responsible for much of the toxicity. And then if you have this enzyme called aldehyde dehydrogenase, this aldophosphamide can be metabolized to carboxyphosphamide, which is inactive. And so what happens in these stem cells is that they have high levels of this enzyme, aldehyde dehydrogenase. So when these stem cells are exposed to cyclophosphamide, they can quickly metabolize it to an inactive metabolite that doesn't affect their biology. And so that's why they're able to survive. Sorry, you have a question.
Yeah, doesn't this make it very easy for the tumor to get resistant?
You mean if they have the enzyme?
Right, that, the genes, right?
I'm sorry?
Like the enzyme is coded in the genome, right?
Right.
It seems like it's a very easy way for the tumor to just like start reading each part of the genome again to get resistant.
Yeah, so that's, you know, that's it's definitely possible that a tumor could develop increased levels of the aldehyde dehydrogenase. And then that may be a mechanism for resistance against chemotherapy. But so I think we usually give cyclophosphamide in context. So outside of the context of transplant, if you're just giving chemotherapy to a patient with a tumor, then typically you would not give single agent cyclophosphamide. Usually it would be in combination with other drugs that you would hope would be toxic to the tumor. And so that's part of the reason behind multi-agent chemotherapy. Because if you look at chemotherapy regimens, very rarely is it just a single agent. At least if you are treating to try to cure the patient. So first line therapies. Sometimes if you are trying second-line chemotherapy for patients with tumors that are already resistant to previous chemotherapy, then you'll use single-agent chemotherapy. And that's mostly because by the time you get to second-line therapy, you're usually not trying to cure the patient, you're just trying to control the disease. So the toxicity from a single agent would be less than the toxicity from multiple chemotherapy agents. So this enzyme is elevated in stem cells, and it's also higher in resting lymphocytes as compared to activated lymphocytes. Okay. So these are the differences between autologous transplant versus reduced intensity allogeneic and myeloablative allogeneic. All three are meant to replace hematopoiesis. There is cytoreduction that goes on. There's more of an immune effect with the allogeneic transplant. And then the main differences between a reduced intensity regimen and myeloablative regimen is that there is less chemotherapy and subsequently there is less toxicity. Okay, so we talked about that. And then we'll talk, are we okay for time? 4:30, right? Yeah, okay. Okay, so now we're going to talk about the different donor sources. And so the donor source of the stem cells reflects the purpose of the stem cell. Autologous transplants are meant to rescue hematopoiesis. There is some immune effect. Allogeneic transplants are meant to rescue hematopoiesis, but there is also a large immune effect against the underlying tumor. This is just a diagram to show that there is some immune effect in an autologous, some immune effect in a syngeneic transplant. So these are patients with leukemia who got transplants from their identical twin. And what they found was that if you gave a higher dose of stem cells, that you had a decreased risk of relapsing. So this is the probability of leukemia-free survival, so how long you are to go without relapse of your leukemia. And they found that if you got more than 3 × 10^8 cells per kilogram, that you were more likely to have longer leukemia-free survival than if you got less. And so these are with syngeneic stem cells, so not really an autologous transplant. But it suggests that even with the same genotype, there is some immune effect with syngeneic transplants. Okay. So we'll talk a little bit about the human leukocyte antigen. And so these are the proteins that present antigenic peptides to T cells. They're on the surface of most body cells, and they are the most important proteins in transplant. They're responsible for graft rejection and graft versus host disease. This is the structure of the HLA molecule. The main thing to know, well, is that we usually look at six of them, A, B, C, D, R, D, Q, to P, and then there are two proteins, one from each parent that you inherit. So these HLA proteins are all located on chromosome 6, and they're all co-expressed on the immune cells. So that's why you can't just match at a few of them, you have to match at all of them, because they're all expressed. They're inherited in a Mendelian manner, so you get one haplotype from each patient. So you have a 25% chance to be a HLA match with your sibling. If you have more siblings, the chance of you having an HLA match goes up. And so this is the formula that we use to calculate what the chance of a match is. So if you have four brothers and sisters, then your chance of having an HLA matching sibling is 1 subtract 0.75 to the third power. So we won't go into this. Okay, so we'll do this because this is important. So this is the difference between HLA matching for a related donor versus an unrelated donor and for a haploidentical donor. So you can ignore this part for now, the low expression level alleles, so the mismatches. So for a related donor, we're looking at mostly three loci, DRB1, B, and A. So because you get one from each parent, there are really six items that we look at. And so that's why we call a match-related donor a 6 out of 6 HLA match donor. If we are evaluating someone to be an unrelated donor, then we're looking at DRB and A, but we're also looking at C, DQ, and DP, and it's really C and DQ. So DRB1, B, A, C, and DQ are 5, and so you get 5 from each parent. So that's what we would call a 10 out of 10 HLA match donor. So the 10 out of 10 refers to DRB1, B, A, C, and DQ. There's a sixth site called DP, and so this works a little bit differently. Because of that, we don't say you have a 12 out of 12, but if you are matched at DP, then we say you are a 10 out of 10 with DP matching, or permissive or non-permissive. And then if you get a haploidentical donor, so someone who matches you at half the available HLA sites, then we're only looking at DR, B, and A for matching. And so you can only get a haploidentical donor from within your own family. So haploidentical donors are actually related donors, but they only match at half the sites that a related donor, that a related 6 out of 6 donor would match at. Okay. In terms of donor selection, we look at the degree of HLA matching, and then we also look at how related you are, so within your own family or an unrelated unrelated person. Sometimes we look at cytomegalovirus status. When we think about age, we usually try to choose the younger donor. Gender is usually not important, except that it's possible for females to have large numbers of children, so we try to choose donors who have not had large numbers of children. And then blood type does not matter in terms of donor matching. Okay, so we'll talk a little bit about acute and chronic graft-versus-host disease. Acute graft-versus-host disease is one of the major complications of allogeneic transplant. And so what happens a lot of times is that we will be able to cure the patients of their underlying disease, but then they develop graft versus host disease, which is sometimes as miserable as having disease. And so the existence of graft versus host disease was predicted by Dillingham, who proposed these criteria for the development for when it would be possible to develop graft-versus-host disease. And so the criteria are listed here. So the important parts are that the graft, the donor graft, has to be immunologically competent. The donor has to be able to react against recipient cells, and because of that, the recipient has to have antigens that are not present in the donor, and so something for the donor to react against. And then finally, the recipient has to be unable to reject the donor cells, because if the recipient is able to reject the donor cells, then the donor can't react, can't have the ability to react against the recipient. So this is acute graft-versus-host disease. Graft-versus-host disease comes in two flavors, acute and chronic. The acute usually manifests as diarrhea, skin rash, liver test abnormalities within the first 100 days. It can happen in anywhere from 20 to 50% of patients who receive an allogeneic transplant. And overall, it's associated in the past with a 15 to 20% mortality. So this is the typical rash that's seen in acute graft versus host disease. It looks a lot like a sunburn, and it's also very itchy in nature. Acute GVHD is a big problem in transplant. If depending on the grade, whether or not you survive the transplant is greatly affected. So if you have grade 4 disease, which is the worst, versus grade 1 disease, then your day 100 survival can go anywhere from 78 to 90% down to 23 to 25%. And so this is old data. This is almost 20 years old. And so the numbers are a little bit better now, but still it has a major impact on survival after transplant. So there are two ways that we can address graft-versus-host disease. One is prophylaxis, which is the prevention of acute graft-versus-host disease, and then actual treatment of graft-versus-host disease. Today we'll only talk about prophylaxis. This is the basic diagram of an allogeneic transplant. And so prophylaxis of acute graft-versus-host disease would start here, right after the cells have gone in, and it would actually start a little bit before as well. Right at the end of the high-dose chemotherapy, or reduced-intensity conditioning chemotherapy. At Roswell, we have two acute GVHD prophylaxis regimens. One is what we call micromethotrexate, and then the other is called post-transplant cyclophosphamide. There is a research protocol that uses alpha-beta T-cell depletion and CD34 selection. We're not going to talk about the alpha-beta T-cell depletion and CD34 selection. We'll only talk about the first two today. So the micromethotrexate consists of three drugs. One is tacrolimus, CellCept, and methotrexate. Methotrexate is given on days 1, 3, and 6. The tacrolimus and MMF start on day minus 1, and they continue until day 60 or day 100, and then they're tapered off. And then what happens is that on day 0, you get the donor infusion. And because the donor infusion contains T cells that have not been exposed to the recipient, the T cells start to proliferate. And so they begin to grow quickly. So on day 1, they get a dose of methotrexate, and that forces down that helps to kill off these immune cells that were proliferating in the recipient that came from the donor. These immune cells continue to proliferate. On day three, the patient gets another dose of methotrexate, and that pushes that down. And then hopefully the cells grow again, and then we push them down again on day 6. And hopefully that is enough to control any graft-versus-host disease that can occur. And we have more patients coming in. Okay. The other regimen that we use is post-transplant cyclophosphamide. Once again, this is based on the unique metabolism of cyclophosphamide in patients. And so there's this very complicated conditioning regimen. And what happens is on day zero, the recipient gets the donor cells. From day zero onward, the T cells proliferate. And we actually kind of encourage the T cells to proliferate because when the T cells are proliferating, they're activating. And the activated T cells generate less aldehyde dehydrogenase. So when day three comes around, which is when we give the high dose of cyclophosphamide, these activated T cells are preferentially sensitive to the cyclophosphamide. And so then that allows them to die off. And then on day five, we give tacrolimus and CellCept. So this is, so we'll skip this part. But this is another way of looking at what happens in patients when they are receiving post-transplant cyclophosphamide. So on day zero, the patient receives the donor cell infusion, and these represent T cells that have receptors to specific antigens. So starting from day zero, the donor lymphocytes are floating around in the patient's body, and they can either encounter antigens that bind to the receptors, or they can not encounter antigens because they simply aren't present in the patient. If they encounter antigens that bind to their receptors, then they become activated. When they become activated, the levels of aldehyde dehydrogenase go down. And then on days three and four, when they're given cyclophosphamide, these activated lymphocytes are preferentially killed off. And then that leaves behind these T lymphocytes that are unreactive to the patient, but hopefully reactive against other things that might come up later, like infections. And they are there in the patient to provide long-term immune reconstitution. Okay. So this is a comparison between the two prophylaxis regimens that are used at Roswell. This is post-transplant cyclophosphamide. This is micromethotrexate. The active ingredients are different. It's cyclophosphamide in one, methotrexate in the other. They both target proliferating T cells, although the micromethotrexate also targets other proliferating immune cells. They all work in vivo, so within the patient as opposed to outside of the patient. They both deplete T cells, and then they have the same tacro and cell set that's given. Okay. So this is So, you know, something to think about, you know, how does Dillingham's hypothesis apply to post-transplant cyclophosphamide use? And so we'll just kind of go through that a little bit right now. So this is Dillingham's hypothesis. If I can find it. Here. So the graft must contain immunologically competent cells. So in post-transplant cyclophosphamide, the recipient gets donor cells that have not been exposed to any immunosuppressants and have not been exposed to cyclophosphamide. That's what allows them to become reactive against recipient antigens. And so that's the second part of Dillingham's criteria, is that the recipient has to have antigens that the donor cells can react against. And then the third part is that the recipient has to be unable to react against the donor cells. And so that's what happens in post-transplant cyclophosphamide. So that's part of the conditioning regimen. The conditioning regimen is given, and it helps to try to reduce the patient's disease, but at the same time, it is also very immunosuppressive. So the other part of graft versus host disease is chronic graft versus host disease. This is usually defined as any graft versus host disease that occurs after day 100, and it's characterized by fibrosis. So the fibrosis can occur in the eyes, in the mouth, it can occur in the skin, and in the muscles and joints. And so this will usually manifest as kind of dry and gritty eyes because the tear glands have become fibrous. And in patients who have a chronic GVHD of the skin and joints, you get this sort of tightening. So it looks a lot like scleroderma. And so this is a patient with chronic graft-versus-host disease. And you see what has happened is that the skin has become tighter and thickened from the fibrosis. This is actually a patient, and it looks like she has a groove in her abdomen from her waist, from her waistline. But this is actually a groove that has developed in the patient because of fibrosis. And then in the mouth, you get kind of these fibrotic lesions as well.